Welcome to the Replatform podcast. You'll listen to the podcast sponsored by Patchworks and hosted by me, James Gerd. Paul Rogers is not in the building today. We bring you interviews with industry thought leaders, C-suite of tech companies, helping you to make better decisions around e-commerce strategy and technology selection. All we ask in return is that you tell other people about the podcast, help us get new listeners, and if it's your first time, give us that rating. So you've got a really interesting topic today. Part of our move towards exploring more around the e-commerce strategy side and operations side, we're talking about building and running e-com teams, and all businesses face this challenge. Like, what resources do you need? How does this change over time? What blend of skills? How do you in-house, outsource? How do you structure it? And we've got a really experienced e-com leader to help us and to get some insights to this and help talk about how she approaches these decisions and what she's learned running e-commerce teams in brands, including Waitrose, This Works, Laura Mercier's and Bare Minerals. So warm welcome, Claire. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, all good for a Monday morning.
Yeah, well, you're brave, wanted to do a podcast recording on a Monday. So this is an important topic because, I'm sure you've gone through this conversation in many businesses, and I've had this conversation asked me with many clients about, how do you structure a team and what are the resources that are most important? So before we get into these exciting questions, let's start with an intro. Do you want to tell people who you are, what your background is, and also that a key thing is what do you think makes a good e-commerce leader?
Yeah, certainly. So, hello, I'm Claire Wilson. I'm digital director. I've got over 20 years' experience in digital now. All started back in the early 2020, I think it was about early 2004. I was lucky enough to be the internet manager for Clinique and launched Clinique as an e-commerce site back in those early days. It's one of the first premium beauty brand to launch online. Amazon sold books. There wasn't really much out there. So I was really, really lucky in those early days to actually be one of the first to launch an e-commerce website. Then moved on to Cowshed, the bath and body brand for Soho House, and launched their site. And then to This Works skincare brand and their site. And then I actually did my own business. So it was a website gifting site called senderthought.co.uk. And it was all about sort of small gifts that fit in letterbox friendly packaging. So you didn't have to be in sign for them. So I was a bit ahead of my time there because that's become like a real thing nowadays. But back then, the only courier was Royal Mail. So it was all about being able to fit in a letterbox. Then moved into strategy and proposition for the likes of Barclaycard and Waitrose, and then moved back to pure digital as digital director for brands such as Laura Mercier and Bare Minerals, which you just mentioned. So quite a lot of digital experience. That's my thing. That's what I love. When we look at traits of a leader, of what makes a good leader, I think the number one has to be strong orchestration. And you do just have to, you know yourself how much there is to juggle with digital, that if you're looking from CRM to acquisition to the site to the customer services, it really is down to the leader to make sure that that is all going in the same direction, being really clear on the objectives of the digital team. And the way I've always phrased it is to make sure that the right hand knows what the left hand is doing and everyone's really working together. I think it's also key to have passion. You've got to love what you do. It's not easy. D2C, e-commerce, digital, it is hard. And you've got to really love it. And I think if you love it, your team will also love it. So having that shared passion is really, really key. I'm very much, celebrate the wins. So I'd always like to give a well done rather than a do better. I think that's what really sort of helps motivate the team. And then lastly, I would finish off with being an exceptional listener. So to really grow an e-commerce business, you've got to listen to your customers. You've got to listen to your team. You've got to listen to your fulfillment house because they're the guys that know what's happening. Like they can really tell you where what's going right, what's going wrong. So it's just making sure that you really are attuned to sort of every party that you work with in a nutshell.
I really like that about telling people well done, because I've always said, having learned the hard way of being thrown into a leadership role when I was pretty too young, is that actually the best leaders are the ones who make their team look good and promote the good work they're doing rather than trying to take the credit. So I really like the way you focus on that. And I know that you're currently looking at what the next role is for you. So what is a perfect role for you? Because you've got so much strategy experience. So what excites you?
Yeah, so it's going to be digital. I think I'd shock everyone if I suddenly said I'm moving away from that. I think what really, really excites me at the moment is, like you said, the strategy, the taking this holistic view of digital. So having done 3 years sort of real hardcore trading in digital, I'm really becoming aware of actually D2C, hugely important, key channel for the brand, for the growth. But a lot of the growth now is starting to become incremental. And actually, if you step back and look at digital as a whole, so, you know, the role of digital in marketplaces, in retail commerce, in quick commerce, and all the different social selling, all the different digital channels, is very much sort of trying to work out actually how do you use digital to get to the right audience with the right products across all of those channels, rather than just kind of having the D2C focus of there's everything else digital going on over here, and here's our own D2C business here. Like, they are so interlinked now, you just can't have that view anymore. So that kind of more holistic approach really appeals to me. So I guess I'm looking for a brand or an agency that's got a similar view in where the digital landscape is going. I'm very keen to work with someone that's about digital as long-term growth, not just as a D2C quick win, because there are just so many brands out there sort of chasing that initial growth, paying over the odds for the customer. It's not sustainable. So I am sort of looking for something more of a grown-up digital.
Patchworks, the world's most modern integration platform. We can connect any key e-commerce system from storefronts to marketplaces and ERPs to fulfillment solutions. This allows retailers and partners alike to simplify their tech stack integration and do away with point-to-point vendor-specific apps. We can automate and streamline the flow of data across your entire e-commerce business. Find out more at wearepatchworks.com.
Excellent. Well, there you go. It's a cool time. So anyone out there who is looking for an experienced digital trader or knows somebody is, then do give Claire a shout after this. We'll put the contact details on the episode landing page. So let's start talking about the e-commerce functions, growing teams and management. So Orvion, you were responsible for establishing the e-commerce function. How do you start? Because I've worked many brands where they might just have one person in-house who's responsible for something and they're trying to grow and they don't know where to go. So how do you start? What do you focus on? How do you know what a brand really needs versus what's an expensive luxury in the early days?
So Orvion was a really interesting case because Orvion had bought the brands Laura Mercier, Bare Minerals and Buxom. So they'd bought three very, very big brands. So you would assume that they had very, very big teams, but they were actually part of an acquisition. They were part of a carve-out. So they were owned previously by another beauty house, Shiseido. And the role of Orvion was to carve these brands out and put them as standalone new within the Orvion business. So it was like running a startup, but for really big established brands. And it was VC backed and everything had to be incredibly lean. So the kind of first step really was being very, very clear on what the company objectives were and what the real must-dos were. And then you build from that. And anything that kind of falls into the nice to do's just goes on the back burner and the headcount doesn't come in yet. So it was having to be really, really focused on what needed to be delivered. And for us, it was very much, you had to replatform the site. So I needed someone with the real experience of Shopify and actually establishing the sites. Laura Mercier desperately needed acquisition because it hadn't been e-commerce before. So you kind of looked at what the priorities were and then you got the headcount in to help build those areas.
And how do you go about structuring the team? Because there's no perfect answer to this, because if you look at, even if you took all the beauty brands and you looked at their team structures, there are some similarities, but they are still divergent. So how do you go about structuring team and why? Like, I guess I've got two questions. This is, what are the critical roles when you're trying to build out an e-commerce team that you can't survive without? And if you had your time again, would you go back and do anything differently?
So I think... So the critical roles, I always like to think of it in the way of the customer journey. So you need to make sure, because ultimately that's what everything is for the customers. So you need to make sure you're supporting that customer with whatever you're doing. So if you think you need someone to look after the acquisition, you need someone to look after the site and the purchase, And then you need someone to help the retention and manage the retention. And through all of that is the thread of customer services. So customer services has to underlie everything to really understand and give the best service. So I think that's how I've always traditionally structured teams. And then depending on the priority of what's needed most, then you kind of upweight each of those areas or become more specialist in those areas. And really, it's the role of the digital director to make sure that all of those areas are actually threaded together. So the danger, and why I'm sort of hesitant, is it the best approach, is that people become quite siloed in what they're doing. But that's, you know, it can work, but you do need a strong leader to make sure all of those threads are tied together.
And do you see the acquisition and retention bit as being an in-house, or do you see that as, is that how you built it out, or was it outsourced, but with the in-house team managing the e-commerce side, which is, like, I guess, the merchandising bit in the middle of the marketing?
Yeah, a mix. Because when you're a small team, it's very hard to have sort of the detailed expertise that you would get with an agency who sort of, you know, obviously does that their bread and butter. So what I tended to do was, for acquisition, yes, we managed it. We managed the agency in-house. They had worked very closely with them, but the actual paid media acquisition activity was outsourced. Likewise with retention, probably more so retention in-house, because it is getting that customer back is quite brand specific. So we did have an agency, but that was very much sort of more to help with the technical side and the sends, etc. But a lot of the strategy was done in-house. So I think it depends on the strength of the team. It depends on how much headcount budget you've got. And you kind of just have to know that there's the basis you need to cover, and you flex for external help as and when you need it.
And I've got a sub question, actually, because I always love hearing the answers. Where does analytics sit? Because you said about you're running it lean like a startup, even though it's VC backed. And I've seen that in many businesses. And actually, having an analytics specialist is a luxury for a lot of businesses running like that. They don't have the headcount to have an in-house e-com analyst. How did you manage that? Because obviously the data side is critical, making sure the analytics is set up right, you're tracking the right events and data, and you generate insights from it. So I'd love to hear how you went about that resource. How did you fulfill it?
So we did go external for that. I was very, very lucky that Lucy, who looked after our acquisition CRM manager, she had a very good knowledge of how things should work. But we used our media agency, who was setting up the whole account. Anyway, they had a specific analytics team. So we used them for a specific project to make sure that all of, because it was during the time as well that we were moving to GA4. So like there was just so much going on with it all. And we were trying to transition the old 360 accounts into Orvian, into GA4. Like it was pretty complex. So we did use the agency for that, and they were phenomenal. They know best practice. They know how it should be done, but closely managed by Lucy to make sure it actually achieved what we wanted to deliver from a client point of view.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, because there are some out there very good in the analytics consultant space who understand the commercial bit and can help you make the right decisions. But generally, somebody internally understands the measurement framework that you need to drive the spec in out, and then as an external specialist to get it set up and tracked properly so the data is correct. It's really important. So yeah, interesting. And a key challenge is, so you've got big brands, they're growing, is evolving a resource model. So you talked about the acquisition, the trading, the retention piece, the customer service. And things change, don't they, as businesses grow, and suddenly one area can become more important than you expected. What for you are the key deciding factors of when you expand your in-house team versus when you just scale up through external?
So I think it really depends on what the challenge is. And if it's something that you foresee is going to be short term, don't hire permanent heads, because it just causes more problems when you're trying to scale in the future if you haven't got the right people in the right places. So the way that I'd sort of start with this is really going, right, why is it I need the headcount? What's the size of the opportunity? What would the return be if we had this headcount? Is it a short or long-term opportunity? What's our current resource? And actually, is there a really good opportunity to offer current resource progression by taking this in? So you kind of look at all those factors, and then I come down to, if you ever use the, it's the 2x2 grid, the effort versus value matrix. And I will literally go, right, okay, what needs doing? Where does it sit? And if something is looking like it's going to be low value and high effort, then don't do it, because it's going to be a lot of energy, but not going to get the return. But the tricky bit with that is normally what falls into that quadrant will be the vanity projects. And it's normally sort of higher up the chain that there's a CEO after a specific digital tool that, although you know it's going to be high effort with little value, so you would normally just knock it off the list. Sometimes you have to do a bit of a case and tread carefully. But my main advice would be don't do it. You then sort of spec out, well, actually, what's high value, and those things that are also, it's high value, but it's going to take a lot of time and effort. So normally those things for an extreme amount of time and effort would be time boxed. So it's then that I'd look for an agency. I'd go, okay, this is really worth doing, but I don't have the resource at the moment to put into this, but it's likely to be more short term. So that's when I'd look at the agency. And then where you're faced with something that's, sort of low value, but low effort, I wouldn't knock it off the list. Although it might not be the highest of value, I'd look at, well, actually, can we just counter for this in the current resource? Because there's still our value. Can you just do this piece of work? And if you can, great, but really keep an eye on creep. Because if it suddenly becomes a higher effort, then, and it's still, and it's low value, then you just need to stop it at some point. But if you can get these kind of, lower value, but they're low effort, then they're worth doing. And then I guess the sweet spot is the high value and the low effort. And they are the things that I love bringing into the team, because they're really motivational. They are the ones that you can really get things done, achieve, but without burning the team out trying to do it. So I definitely recommend looking up the effort value matrix and just plot everything that way.
Yeah, do you know what? I will stick it on the landing page for this, because I love it. In all my training courses I run, I stick that up. And yeah, effort, value, effort, impact. And I always, the high effort, low impact, I call them thankless tasks. And they're in red because it's, why would you do this? Why would you prioritize it?
Not because you're being asked to. And you're like, no.
I know, but this is great, because this how I think help people listening, because this can help how you plan, because that was a question to you, like, how are you prioritizing, what are you focusing on? And I like the fact that you then couched what do you in-house based on what impact will it be on the people, and how much enjoyment will they get from it? Because if they can see they're delivering tangible results and in a good time frame, the motivation you get from that versus a project that's going to take 12 months and is really bloody tough and complex with lots of road bumps, that's generally when actually you're right, having part of that outsourced so that the heavy lifting can be done by a partner, so the team can focus on stuff that's going to give them satisfaction. I really like that.
Yeah,
great. It's a great framework.
Right.
Right. Next link to that. When you were speaking, it triggered something in my head. I get triggered a lot these days. It's talent retention. I'd love to hear your advice, because it's such a competitive market out there for good e-commerce people, not just e-commerce people, but we're focused on e-com. What have you learned? What are your techniques? How do you keep people motivated? How do you keep good people who, other than a salary, I mean, that's table stakes, but the stuff that makes a difference to people's satisfaction and desire to stay and work as part of the team?
I think it does come back to choosing the work that goes into the team. It is inherently 99.9% of people want to do a good job, and they want to do well, and they want to see results. So it's creating an environment that gives them that. It comes back to, as well, sort of realistic targets. Like, everyone wants X amount of growth and da 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 da. But if that's not achievable, it's really, really tough on a D2C team, because it's so accountable with all the visibility of metrics there is around it. And so I think it's really trying to make sure that people are challenged and they're learning, which invariably always are with e-commerce. But knowing, you know, making sure people feel like they are doing a good job, they are adding value, even when times are tough, like everyone needs to know that what they're doing is for a reason. Otherwise, it's very demoralizing. Even myself, like if I'm working really, really hard and you don't feel it's for anything, then it's, you know, we're all human. We all, you know, you're not going to sit there for hours working hard for no reason. So I think a lot about it, and like I mentioned in the introduction as well, is passion for what you do spreads across the team. So there will always be ups and downs in trading in digital. And I think as a leader, if you can make sure that you are almost like the, you know, you steer the ship through those times and keep everyone with a cool head and positive, they'll follow the lead. And so again, I think it comes down to the leadership.
Fully agreed. I think a strong leader is more valuable during tough times. Not that they're not useful at other times, but when things aren't going well, when targets aren't being hit, when the pressure's on, to take that pressure away from the team to allow them to focus on delivery and keep an eye on them to make sure they're still motivated and happy is such an underrated quality.
And it is. It's just the checking in. It's acknowledging that it's tough, and there's nothing worse that you're beating yourself up anyway, that it might be a tough trading time. You haven't hit where you should be. The last thing you need is someone else to like stamp it on your head saying, why haven't you hit it? You're like, I know I haven't hit it. So I just think that's the role of a strong leader, to keep people's like spirits up, even though when the times are tough.
Yeah. And I think it links back to that comment you said earlier about, you know, the quadrants and the fact that something you thought might be a, what I call the fill-ins, which is low effort, low impact. Mm. You don't want to lose sight of. And you're right that sometimes things change, whether it's economic situations or resourcing, cost, whatever, and all of a sudden that goes from low effort to high effort. Having someone who's guiding them and being able to react because they're strategically keeping an eye on it all to go, guys, we're not pushing this anymore because it's going to grind you into the ground and you're not going to hit your objectives because now things are changed. I think that's so important, having that strategic perspective. So let's talk about the planning bit now. Planning becomes more and more important as the business grows and you've got more people, more growth, etc. What, as the leader of an e-com team, what are the processes that you focus on that you think are just critical to get right to make a team work effectively?
I think it is having that longer term view. And as the leader, you roughly know where you are and where you're going to be expected to be in 18 months, or 18 months, 2 years. Like you've got a good idea of what's coming your way and what you're going to be asked to deliver. And I think it's really important to then map out, well, what are the building blocks that are going to get you there? Like what are the key projects? What are the key areas across all of the D2C business that needs to be delivered to kind of add up to that end game? And yes, things will change and, you know, 18 months is a long time and who knows what happens in 18 months, but you know, if you've got to go high level and think, right, I'm going to get there. This is how we'll do it. And then I literally map out by quarter what the key deliverables would be. And the reason why it's really important to map out that early is because the last thing you want to do is be trying to deliver like four massive projects in one quarter, or trying to suddenly everything gets phased into peak. Like you need to go really look at the ones that are going to make the biggest difference, the biggest impact. Put those out on a timeline and on a plan, get the team on board, get everyone aware of what's happening, why. And you have to really go, you know, be led by what's viable and feasible as well, because you may want to do something in Q2, but if you actually haven't got the budget or the right resource at that point, don't try doing it. You'll have to move it to Q3 and vice versa. So it's like a bit of a jigsaw really on it. I keep doing this because it's the timeline. It's, you know, it's getting that timeline and literally popping in the priorities, the projects that are going to help you hit the overall, but at the right time.
Yeah, I think it's a real art and science, isn't it, of managing time. As I did a little talk at Paul's at an in-house Vivant conference last week, and I did a talk about that whole movement piece, because you can have a plan and plans change, and strategically need to be on top of knowing when things aren't going to be realistic and when you need to shift it, versus when you persist with your current plan. It's quite a challenge. So let's move on to data, the next big challenge. Because data, there is so much data. You alluded to earlier how much data you have in D2C. And data you do nothing with becomes almost like a vanity thing. It's like, okay, why are we using it if we're not doing anything with it? So I'd love to know, data that can drive change and decision-making and improvements, what metrics do you focus on? So let's take the trading piece, which is huge in D2C e-commerce teams. What the metrics, KPIs that you focus on that you use to meaningfully improve things?
So I'll pick on your word meaningfully, actually, because I think obviously D2C trading, AOV, visitor numbers, conversion rate, all essential, and they are a good kind of litmus as to how you're performing. But I always feel with conversion rate, we'll go, great, we've got a really high conversion rate, but it's probably because your visitor numbers are low. it's, you know, it only tells part of the story. And I think the thing that can give the best overall story is customer metrics. They're not always easy to get, but where you can, I think it's essential, because that is what's going to tell you what the health of your digital business is. So CSAT, post-purchase, essential, either with the customer service team or the post-purchase surveys. Just trying to get that verbatim, that sense check of, are our customers happy? Are we ever going to see them again? I think the repeat purchase percentage is one to really keep an eye on as well. And it's interesting because you sort of don't want it to go too high because you're not acquiring new, but you don't want it to drop either. So it's almost like as the business grows, you want to maintain your repeat purchase. I think that would be my holy grail, is that as long as I can always keep that, as we're growing, that number of customers coming back, then you're in good shape. And then I think the third one that I like to look at is the brand search term demand. So if you look at how many customers are searching for your brand online, I always find this one a really interesting one to correlate next to D2C growth, because what you'll often see is your targets are set saying we want 20% growth from D2C, but actually when you see the increase in brand searches are only up 5%, you can kind of question, well, actually, well, where's that growth going to come from if the brand isn't growing that quickly? Or conversely, if the D2C business isn't growing as much as the popularity of the brand, why not? So I find that a really useful one, just as a sense check as well on kind of the health of the whole business rather than just looking at the D2C part.
Yeah, I think that's really nice. And I also think it's a good proxy for looking at the impact of paid media on cutting through dependency just on brand, isn't it? Because if you start to see more non-brand demand coming through, you know that you're starting to expand keyword reach, keyword interest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I'd love to drill into, actually, because you talk about CSAT, like MPS, CSAT, whatever acronyms people are using out there. I'd love to know, how do you use it? Because I know some businesses who report on it and do nothing, others who do really smart for them. So yeah, what are your tips and advice on how you can use changing CSAT numbers to either improve what you do with customers or react to issues?
Yep. So I think, Kasia, our name checker, absolutely fabulous, and looked after our customer service at Orvion. And she was really good at getting the right reporting and the right metrics to be able to tell the story of what was happening with our customers that week. So again, coming back to what I mentioned earlier, that just looking at a metric, a stat, doesn't tell you everything. So for example, we'd always want to keep our CSAT, our customer service rating, at around 4.4. Wouldn't want it to go below 4.4. And if it did, it'd be like, well, why? But actually, invariably, what happened was if it's gone lower, we may have been having out of stock issues. So is that something the DC team, is it in their control? Often not. But we were aware, and then we could actually tailor our messaging to help customers that if their shade wasn't in stock, et cetera, or, you know, to give an expectation of when it might arrive. So it's taking that number, but then putting the story behind it, which I think is really key.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's one of the most underutilized metrics in e-com personally. And I know that there are businesses, obviously, there are leaders like yourself who use it effectively, but it's still a lot of businesses I speak to, and I say, customer experience is huge to us, how would you measure it? And then it's blanks because people aren't using it. And it's such an untapped potential. So let's go into a bit more about reporting. You mentioned about customer service team do really smart reporting analysis. Who should own reporting in an e-com team? Like, who do you normally give that to? Does that sit with you as a leader? Does it sit with the trading person?
It comes up to me. So the way, I mean, it really is, especially with D2C, the more information you give, the more you're going to be asked. But you have to be quite selective how much to pull together, because there is just so much and everyone wants to interpret it in a different way. So what I'd normally advocate is a weekly report of, give like the health check of the business. And that's like the real, you know, the stats, what are we seeing, what's up, what's down, is there anything that's sort of hugely worrying or a challenge, an opportunity emerging. And you set up the template that I like to see the information in. It's what I read, and then the actual team complete this. So be that head of acquisition, head of retention, so everyone gets their own different part. Then comes back to me with the heads to say, right, what are we seeing across all of the areas? Once we're happy with kind of the narrative and what we're seeing as a business, that gets shared with the rest of e-commerce team, because it's amazing how many e-commerce teams don't actually see the weekly reporting for the business. So that gets shared with the rest of the team. And then also we'll go to the senior leadership team. So that's the weekly sense check, how's the business performing? And then on a monthly basis, there's more of a kind of a monthly brand review. So this is where the D2C channel, the marketing channel, the PR channel, they all form part of the monthly report. And I will use the weekly reports to produce that, because that's what goes to the XCOM. And what I like to do there is to give what are opportunities and challenges, because there's no point sending these guys a report without saying, A, what we could be going after, and then maybe where I need their support from as well. So you know, the reports where you just send up good news are a bit pointless, really, because there's always something else that could be done. Yeah. And if you don't say it, then you're only going to be asked why you didn't ask for it in the next XCOM review. So definitely use those monthly reports to start sort of saying what could be done. And wait.
I really like that, actually. I guess it comes back to like the classic models of like SWOT, for example, that having to, because nothing's ever perfect. There's always something we can do better. There's always a threat out there or something changing. And you're right, sanitizing that to like the senior leadership team is really, really important, because then there aren't surprises. And also, you're right, I mean, how do you get buy-in from other teams if the people aren't perceiving the impact of not acting on something? I'm gonna have to tap you up after this recording to see if you'll share like a template with us. I love seeing other people's reporting templates, and then borrowing and stealing and begging from them to improve my own as an econ. So that, I'd love to drill into trading a bit more. I've had lots of chats with various people over the years about how they structure trading meetings and what they focus on. And some have like a trading meeting, they say to me, I'll only do a maximum of half an hour, I want it quick, I want it fast. And we use a rapport from generating on the Friday to drive it and make it efficient. And others who say, no, we have 4 hours and it's the most important time in our whole week. What is your take? What is a good trading meeting? And what do you expect to be in that trading meeting, and who needs to be in it?
So there's kind of, I've got two elements to trading actually. And yes, there's that first approach of, okay, reasonably quick, an hour on a Monday, once we've pulled together all the information for the weekly report, everyone together to go, what are we seeing? What's working? What's not working? What do we need to pivot? Do we need to gap fill? Or actually, whew, we can actually do some of our other work because we're not panicking to hit target. So it's so that Monday session is really key to kind of get the sense check of where we're operating on a day-to-day. But in terms of trade planning, I like those to happen on a fortnightly basis. And within that, it should be probably about an hour. You don't need them too lengthy if you're having it on a regular basis. But there should be the marketing, someone from marketing. There should be someone from PR. There should be the digital team, and there should be customer services. Customer service is key. They need to know what's going on. And you will map out. So you get your monthly target, you break it down into weeks, and you've got to map out by week what activity you're going to do to be able to hit those targets. So you start at the top. You start with marketing and brand, what product launches, what key messages, what's happening for the brand. And so you're made aware of that by the marketing team. That's really key that you start high level, because that's the messaging we're trying to get out to the customer. Then move on down with PR as well. So PR also saying what influencer activity, et cetera, is happening. What do they know about? So you're aware, and you can, if you've suddenly got this amazing influencer piece coming up, how can we then maybe replicate that on the site, et cetera? So once you know kind of like the broader level messaging of what's happening for the brand, and you've plugged in your key events like Mother's Day or Easter, you then come down to more the trading and the activation. So with the knowledge of being in line with the brand, you then, and what is happening elsewhere in the business and out in the calendar, you set your targets and you plan in then your activation. So be it your email, be it your PPC, be it your site activity, promotions, in accordance to that weekly calendar. And if suddenly you see that you've got a really high target 1 week, but there isn't really the messaging and the activation for that, that's when you have to come up with something, because you can't come up to the week before and go, oh yeah, we already know we're not going to hit target next week. People aren't going to take that. So it's that forward planning. So I like to meet every 2 weeks to discuss the next 3 months of trading. And you won't get completely buttoned down to the end of the 3 months in that session, but it's like a rolling basis of making sure that the activity that's happening is going to actually deliver what target you need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I really like that. Actually, I like the cadence of that as well, because yeah, the weekly one amongst the core e-com team for trading updates is so important. But I like the idea of doing it fortnightly rather than monthly on the trade planning. And interestingly, it's really good to hear this, actually, because I'm going through this with a client at the moment, trying to advise them on how they manage this process and structure to do their trading planning. And I've been debating in my head about how often should that second piece be, and I think fortnightly makes perfect sense, actually. So it's very useful.
Things change quickly. Things do, like suddenly you need like delays in product launches, or something's not going to happen. So a month is too long, in my opinion.
Yeah, agreed. That's why in my head I was thinking, I don't want, because they're trying to do so much so quickly, and I was thinking I don't want to overburden them with meetings. But you're right that things change so quickly that you can't leave it for too long. And it's that alignment between marketing, e-com, merchandising, and customer service, and making sure that the customer service impact of things is understood, and that feedback loop is there so that people don't keep pushing things that are causing issues. I really like that that structure. So let's close on a nice I like to do nice tangible closes. So we've talked about lots of things in this episode, which I think are really useful for people. Can you pick out a top tip? Because you talked about earlier about when times are hard, keeping people focused and motivated. What is your number one top tip when trading is tough, which it has been over the last 12 or so months? What's your top tip for e-commerce leader providing like guidance and support for their e-commerce team? What's the number one thing people should take away?
So absolute number one, sugar, caffeine and donuts. No, I'm kidding. That's me personally. Like, you know, step when it's stressful. And my coffee on tap. No. So I think the number one thing is accepting that there will be peaks and troughs, and there are things that are out of your control. So, you know, we've all been there when there's snow and deliveries can't happen, or strikes and deliveries can't happen, or we've had our major payment provider issues over some quite serious trading times where we couldn't take payments. And, you know, these things do happen. And I think all you can do is make sure that these things don't drag the team down. It's really important to keep kind of the spirits up. And actually, my last GM is just absolutely amazing. Loved working for her, Helen Wood, amazing. She used to always just say, is the world still turning? And it was always, well, yes, it is. And it just kept everyone so balanced. And it's really stuck with me. And it's something that I'll always maintain, that as long as the team has tried their hardest, they've given it their all, they've gap filled where possible, then, you know, you can't ask anymore. And ultimately, the world is still turning. And there will always be ups and downs. And I think it's so easy to get stuck in a rut of down. You just have to move on. You just have to move away from it.
I really, really like that. And it's that classic don't sweat the small stuff thing, is see the bigger picture. I really like that. So as a takeaway top tip. Claire, like, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I could carry on for hours and hours. And I'm sure when we meet up at Vivant Pulse, I'll be picking your brain on other questions. And if anyone wants to connect and anyone wants to hear Claire talk more around e-commerce, she's going to be on one of the key panels at Vivant Pulse event in May. We'll be talking about customer experience, so that's going to be a cracker. But and if you do want to reach out, if you are interested in chatting to Claire about the digital director role, then obviously you can get our contact details off of the landing page on the website. But what's if people aren't looking at the landing page, what's the best way to reach out if they do have a role they think you might be interested in?
Go for LinkedIn. LinkedIn's my friend right now. Best by me, Claire Wilson, digital director on LinkedIn.
Amazing. And thanks everyone as always for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have done. Keep an eye out for the next one. We drop one every week. And if it was your first time, don't forget to give us that rating before you go. Goodbye, everybody. For more information on this topic, head over to replatform.fm for our audio podcasts. To discuss a project, or if you'd like to chat about any of the topics covered in this episode in more detail, please reach out to myself, James Gerd, or my co-host, Paul Rogers, via LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and keep your ears peeled for the next episode.